normalization occurred. One question in retrospect that I wanted to ask you about. Do you think in any way that it could have been handled better than it was? Did we make any mistakes?
Well, I think maybe I should say this. Okay. I think looking back, the thing that worried me then and still worries me in retrospect is the congressional, I think the Congress could have been handled better. It was very touchy. But I think there should have been a wider touching of base than simply with the majority leader of the Senate. But I don't think that was just peculiar to this incident. There were difficulties between the Carter administration and the Congress right from the beginning. It was in when I was back home in February 1978, I went to see Tip O'Neill, whom of course I'd known for years. My purpose in going to see him was to urge him to head up one of the White House congressional delegations to China, because I thought it would help with the Chinese and also obviously help with the Congress. In that regard, he said to me, I can't go, Leonard, because they won't let me take Mrs. O'Neill. I said, what did you say? He said, they won't let me take Mrs. O'Neill. Okay. So I said to him, what did you say? He said, they won't permit wives to go on these delegations. I said, who won't permit wives? He said, the Department of State. So I went back and raised Cain about that, and we got the rule changed. I guess it came about in the first instance because of the need to accommodate numbers.
That's right.
But I got great credit with some congressional wise for changing that rule. But then he went on to say, this was the point of my bringing this up, we were sitting almost nose to nose on two chairs. And he said, you know, Jimmy Carter is a great man. He's an honorable man. He said, you can go up there and discuss problems with him and reach an honorable conclusion. He kept emphasizing honorable. But then he started tapping my knee. He said, Leonard, those guys around him, they don't think like you and me. Now, you know, this was the Speaker of the House. And unfortunately, nothing was done, really, by the White House staff to get to know the Congress. They treated them almost with contempt, as though it were another state legislature. And of course, that relationship really meant that this problem, which was going to be so difficult in the Congress anyway, should have been caucused. Let's use that word far more than, well, it wasn't caucused at all.
Well, you know, as I think back on my own role and my deficiencies in performance of that role, this is one area where I think your indictment pertains to me too. I had no background.
Well, I wouldn't expect
Congress,
you to have,
but none. But I was called upon to go up to the Hill to brief congressmen, and was called upon to think through the legislative strategy, and I had just no preparation for that. And in fact, just on the point you were making concerning congressmen taking their wives, State Roy and I decided that.
Really?
Yeah.
That they should go.
They should not go.
Oh, they should
not. And Harry too. Harry, Stape, and I all thought that the previous trips were congressional junkets, and that we wanted to send more congressmen and to make it serious. Mm. But that was we were not being sensitive to the politics of it. We were just looking at it, and I was looking at it as a as an educational exercise in trying to cut down the junk tearing, didn't approach it from a political point of view. And it took really till nearly the end of my time before I understood what I was engaged in. Dick Holbrook was perhaps the only member of the crew who understood it. Spig did not.
Well, again, he wouldn't have that kind of background. You know, I used to tread the halls of Congress, and I worked in congressional campaigns. I knew the congressional side really well, just as well, certainly, as I knew the executive
mm-hmm.
side.
Mm-hmm.
And well,
but the one senator that I treated as I should have treated many others, and it was totally in my capacity and discretion, was Senator Jackson. And I made it a point to go up. I briefed him on China policy. I kept him abreast. He was slightly hurt that he had not been informed, but I called him and apologized, and he felt we really did have a special relationship as a result of my frequent briefings. And I think I could have done the same thing with John Glenn, and I didn't do it. And I feel bad. And with John Glenn, letting him begin to realize that normalization could occur if I saw him one-on-one. I saw Jackson one-on-one. I was worried with Glenn that I would not be able to see him one-on-one, but I'm sure in retrospect that I could have made that arrangement, and Roy Werner and then his successor, Carl Ford, would have understood, and John Glenn probably wouldn't have told him, but I didn't trust him enough.
I see. Well, John, the fact that John Glenn was not more clued in was particularly unfortunate.
That's right.
Because we had, when the crunch came, after normalization in the Congress on the Taiwan Relations Act, we had no real advocates for a sensible handling of the problems.
Of course, that partly was the problem with Frank Church, and as the Cuban Missile Brigade incident showed, we were probably wise in not bringing Church fully in our confidence.
Well, you know, if we got to the question of how should it have been done, I think it would have been unwise to have done it at too early a stage. But since there was a unanimous Senate resolution, that there would be full consultation, and as I think I've said on this record before, the point we knew we were going to get it home
that week before,
and that we were going, that they were going to be willing to normalize, even knowing that we reserved the right to sell defensive arms to Taiwan. If the president had called in the selected group and said, "Now, I want to normalize. Will you support me if I can normalize relations but still keep a free hand, at least for the time being, or even leaving that out, on selling as needed, if needed, defensive arms to Taiwan, will you
mm-hmm.
support me?" I think he'd have gotten an absolute affirmative on that, because many of them would have thought that was impossible. I know that from individual conversations in China. Well, it's nice what you say, but that can't happen, Leonard, you know, that sort of thing.
And if we had gotten a statement from the Chinese, we would have been criticized for believing it. So that was...
You mean a statement about non-use, of
that's
course.
That's right. It wouldn't
such a statement was meaningless.
And of course. Well,
if they were bound and determined to act in that fashion, a pious declaration of the contrary earlier would have... No,
yes.
Substance at all.
Do you think that we hastened the discussion in that last week too much, that it would have been better to have not had that frenetic exchange of cables, but maybe let the negotiations be a little more protracted and button them up just before January 1, so that there wouldn't have been that curious 15-day hiatus between public announcement and... formal recognition.
As I had said in our cable detailing what had happened in the first session on December 13, Chinese Day. I know I put in at the end that something to the effect that possibly now is the time, or maybe even stronger than that, to consult congressional leadership. If that had happened and we had taken our time, say 2-3 days is all that would have needed, it seemed to me, before we responded, both the Chinese and we knew that we were home free.
Yes.
Because the issues that were outstanding were certainly manageable. We knew they were going to normalize, even though we had this reservation to which they were absolutely opposed. And that was the time to do the political homework.
So that I agree with you on that. I mean, that's why I raised the questions. I think that that a mistake was made in imposing this December 15 deadline for an announcement as soon as we got your cable of your first meeting with Deng, that probably it would have been better to let it slide into the next week, maybe have you go in and say, we are now convinced that normalization will occur, we'll be back in touch with you very soon, and something along those lines. But there's another reason for that, by the way. I think that it was that we lost Twin Oaks for the Chinese as a result of the way it was handled. That 15-day period was used by the nationalists, you will recall, to transfer Twin Oaks.
Yes.
And I think that if we had made the announcement coincidental with the issuance of the joint communique, then Twin Oaks would not have been transferred. It would not have been legally possible for them to transfer it.
That's true, and of course, as you know, we urged the Chinese to take legal action, which they flatly refused to do.
Right.
I know Chuck Percy, Senator Percy, who was not too helpful in other regards in the Taiwan Relations Act. Remember, he had an amendment that came very close to passage that would have even been more distasteful
yes.
to the Chinese than what was finally in the law. But on the question of the property, he was totally on the Chinese side. And he came back to the Senate floor from a lunch at the Chinese liaison office and made a legislative record, having in mind it being helpful to the PRC in gaining control of that property. And then he sent all this to me, and I took that record and went in to see Jiang Wenjin, explaining to him the difference between the cold language of the law, as far as the courts are concerned. They always look at legislative intent. And there was a good exchange on that floor. And those who were on the other side of the question, wanting the Taiwan people to keep that property, didn't quite know what was going on, so it was an excellent exchange as far as legislative intent was concerned. It was between Frank Church, I guess, as the manager of the bill, and Senator Percy, but some on the other side of the question asked some questions, as I remember it, which were helpful in this regard. So I take this in, gave them a copy, explaining legislative intent and how this can be helpful, and urging them again. And I did this unofficially to go into court, but they were very stiff-necked on that, as you know. And when they finally came around, the die was already cast, and when they finally did get an attorney,
it was too late.
He told them that the cause is hopeless.
They'd waited far too long.
Right.
Yes, yes. Well, let us move on.
So we left off, I think, with my telling about the Grassley, who was our security chief, who scheduled an open house on Sunday, December 17th, for all of our Chinese staff, without any knowledge, of course, of what was happening, and that turned into a very joyous occasion. And it's interesting, the ambassadors who people came to call to find out about the details of where we were. The first was, of course, the British ambassador, Bangladeshi ambassador, Japanese ambassador, the Greek ambassador, that more because he was a good friend and our neighbor, the Indian ambassador, Sata, who subsequently went back to India very shortly after that to become Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, so a prominent person in the Indian Foreign Civil Service. Really quite not enthusiastic, but solidly in support of the step as being a contributor to stability in Asia. The Sri Lankan ambassador, who was totally in support. And those were all the ambassadors who took the trouble to come to inquire about it.
And what were their inquiries directed toward?
The details, how it would work, how would representation work on the island, and of course the arms sales question that engaged there.
Was there curiousness as to why the timing?
Not that I remember particularly. In that little inner circle, there was inner circle, by that I mean the NATO people and those who would normally be close to us, and the Japanese. Sato, the Japanese ambassador, and I had a close relationship. I freely spoke to him about the benefit it would be politically to us for the Japanese to conclude a peace and friendship treaty with the Chinese, which of course they had done in August. I remember when he came to tell me about it, he says, "Now it's your turn." So that was, it was generally taken for granted. Maybe not that quickly, but the thing was in motion.
Uh-huh.
And Sato,
would probably well-chosen words. That would be something he just wouldn't say himself, would he? Or
oh,
would
no.
That have reflected his government's view, too?
I think his government's view. But I think I put on this record that I got to know him personally so well because I'd met him in Tokyo, right. And then I went to the airport to greet him when he came a couple of weeks after I had done in 77. And when in a more formal meeting, I asked him if he was going to be in China as long as his predecessor, who'd been there, I think, 4.5 years, he told me very frankly that his purpose there was to normalize relations, and that when that was accomplished, he would be going back to Japan, which within a very few months, less than a year after the Peace and Friendship Treaty, he went back to Tokyo. Mm-hmm. 902, on the 23rd of December, Japanese TV sent over a team to interview me. And then we had, of course, the Christmas interlude.
And the staff just overwhelmed with work at this time, as I recall.
Right, and the,
everything descended on us. You had very few staff. How many people were, I mean, it was really an embassy at that point, a liaison.
Total of 33 at that point.
And
that included all the Americans, 33.
And from the time of normalization to about June, I think it was the most busy embassy in the world, wasn't it? I remember some report.
Yes, of course. In that period, we increased the number. At this time, we had no military representatives at all.
Right.
And I might say that one of the first inquiries that Washington told me about was the Pentagon had 35 that they were ready to send us right away, which was more than the total number we had in all the branches of the mission.
What did the staff learn about the negotiations after it was done? Did you brief them rather extensively as to each of the sessions that you had and what had transpired? And there must have been keen interest in the background.
Not in the detail, except with regard to the relationship between the normalization and the arms sales question, in which, of course, there was a very keen interest in a disbelief that it could have happened with that known reservation. Or a surprise, let me take away disbelief, surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was somewhere in this period that Chinese wanted to know, well, what are we going to do on the day itself, the day of normalization, January the 1st?
Oh, yes. Okay.
And we had thought about it. Obviously, we had to have an affair of some kind. We came to the notion of a reception. Should it be a massive reception, including all the diplomatic community and so on, and should we go to a hotel or outside? We felt very keenly that it should be on U.S. property, if you can call a rented place U.S. property, and that we said we hoped that Deng Xiaoping and and others who had been closely associated with the American-Chinese development would come. And then they told us that they were going to do the same sort of thing with a reception at the at their liaison office in Washington, and that they hoped the same, that there would be high-ranking Americans, as I remember it.
We carefully discussed that so that it would be precisely the same. You remember we were in extensive cable contact.
Right.
Who was going to attend? Was Huang Hua going to be their head person? And then finally we got it to Vice President Mondale on our side, and I think Deng Xiaoping came on their side.
Deng Xiaoping came, and also, I note that on Sunday, December the 30th, in anticipation, I think, of that, I had a round of press interviews, Ian McKenzie of Reuters, also fronting for People's Magazine. That was the beginning of an interview which never saw the light of day. Fox Butterfield, the New York Times, John Roderick of AP, and Bob Crabb of UPI. They had come, I guess they came at that point only temporarily.
Yes, they were there to cover the January 1st festivities.
Then on that same day, December 30th, previously arranged without regard to the normalization event, was Codell Ashley, Lud Ashley of Toledo,
mm-hmm.
an old friend,
mm-hmm.
was the chairman of the group, and included in that group was Kelly. What was his first name? Tall Republican from Orlando, Florida.
Oh, the guy who
Abscam.
Abscam.
He was the only Republican caught in the Abscam net. Well, Kelly was a very difficult person.
Conservative too.
Extremely conservative, reactionary conservative, and very difficult to get along with. And the setup, we were going to take our dining, the downstairs area, the public dining room, give it that term, which was quite sizable, as you know. We were going to set up the couches there so that the VIPs would be there. And the fact we had a congressional delegation on our hands simply complicated that logistics problem. Then outside the dining room, not outside, but the reception area, which was, of course, more sizable. We completely took all furniture out of there to, so so that we could have as many people as possible standing. And I think we got some 350 in there. Well, the congressional delegation, there must have been seven of them, as I remember, seven, eight. And we had worked out circle number one, which on the Chinese side would include Deng Xiaoping, Fang Yi, Wang Hua, the foreign minister, and their wives. That would be six. And then myself and Sharon. And so we were going to have Lud Ashley as chairman and his wife. Well, Mr. Kelly made it clear that that would be bipartisan as far as circle number one was concerned. And the other arrangements they were clearly dissatisfied with. I'm waiting for a signal from Chairman Ashley, and he's silent. Finally, Representative Ocar, a woman Democrat from Cleveland, whom of course I also knew, said, well, Kelly, I can't think of his first name. She said, he's the ranking Republican. Maybe he should be in circle number one. And I wait again for the chairman, who says nothing, and so I shrug my shoulders, which could mean, well, maybe, or okay, or whatever. As we're walking out, I'm walking along with the chairman. He says, over my dead body. So Sharon and I were down. This all took place on the evening of Sunday, the 31st of December. The Kodal Ashley came over at 5 o'clock for a briefing. And this all took place at that time. Then we went with them to their welcoming banquet. And then at 10:45, CBS was in the residence for a TV interview. And after that, Sharon and I, the staff all having... No, the staff was still there because of the TV interview. We rearranged the circles. We had four or five circles in the dining room. And we enlarged circle number two to make a place for Mr. Kelly, so that we kept to our original plan for circle number one. Comes the time on the 1st of January, and we're seated. The television, of course, is there in the entranceway from the reception hall into the dining room. May I make a digression here? We had all the networks, as I remember it, so we had a little, or did we?
I think you did.
Yeah, all the networks.
Massive coverage.
And there's not that much room. And we were worried that the American network people would jostle out the Chinese from any,
right,
any chance to get any shots. We didn't need to worry because it was the other way around. The Chinese were very aggressive. And they kind of pushed the Americans out of the way.
Did the Americans have pool TV, or was it three separate cameras?
I think they had three separate cameras. Huh. It was an awful jam.
So you didn't pool it.
And we are seated. The main couch is facing the entranceway and where the TV cameras will be. Deng Xiaoping is next to me. And then Fang Yi is the other side of him, and Wang Hua is on a couch that went at right angles from that, and his wife, and Mrs. Lud Ashley, and Mrs. Ashley. And then on this side, Deng Xiaoping's wife, and Fang Yi's wife, and Sharon. And by the way, Sharon had to introduce Fang Yi's wife to Deng's wife. They had never met.
Is that right?
It's a...
That's fascinating.
Yeah, they had never met.
But Fang Yi knew Madam Jo Lin.
Yes, yes, yes. And if you remember, when the delegation came to the United States, we had great difficulty with Fang Yi's wife because she was so withdrawn, shy,
very retiring,
And Sharon made a special project of making sure she was included as much as possible.
Yes, she was not accustomed to the limelight.
No,
clearly, she
no.
had been a
didn't like it.
Very modest person.
So as we were all seated, and suddenly I see Mr. Kelly, very tall. He's talking to the chairman, Mr. Ashley. I can't hear what they're talking about, but I assume he's complaining about his seating. And then I hear the chairman say to him in a louder voice, "It's up to the ambassador." And he starts to move around, coming to me, and I thought, my golly, we're going to have all the cameras are on. We're going to have a scene. And he reaches down to whisper to me, and he has a copy of Time magazine with Deng's picture on the front as Man of the Year. And he says, "Would you get his autograph for me?" So I got his autograph, Deng's autograph for him, and he went away and sat peacefully in his circle number two. That didn't stop him blasting the whole business when he got to Hong Kong
right.
a few days later.
He was a pro-Taiwan person.
But we had then had it arranged after a certain interval that we would go up to the microphones and exchange toasts. I was first, of course, as the host, and then the vice premier responded. I had told him twice that when you get through, Mr. Vice Premier, we have firecrackers hanging outside, Chinese firecrackers, those long strings, you know, with those
yeah.
very loud bangs. And as soon as you are through, we will set off those firecrackers. He really jumped when that happened. It must have skipped his mind. I was, of course, right beside him. He had also...
He thought they were shots.
Yes. That was his first reaction.
Huh.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yes. And as we were walking up to the microphones were in the entranceway so the people in the other room could see as well as hear. And the carpeting in the dining room stopped. There was a space, and then the carpeting... reception area began, and the pressure of the crowds was a little gap into which his foot went, and he stumbled. If you remember that, there was some Western press speculation as to his physical ability. It was because, of course, everybody jumped to aid him. It was purely an accident. It could have happened to,
sure.
to a 30-year-old. And it was a very, very auspicious event.
Well, I remember
went beautifully.
I remember exchanging cables with your staff on the toasts and what kind of, because we were very concerned with what Mondale should
right.
say, and we sent out, I think, a copy of Mondale's toast to you. That was another, I remember one of these... moments of NSC state differences, because we wanted Mondale to be extensive and very gracious in his toast, and state wanted it. Harry, I mean, it was quite specifically, Harry wanted just a very short, perfunctory toast. Oh, we had a horrible argument over that. How long should it be, and all of that. Was your toast in situations like that extemporaneous, or did you have a state for somebody to
It would depend on the event. This one was written out in advance, and I think we had the first draft made by Charlie Sylvester, then Stape and I worked it over.
I don't remember. We didn't. That you was totally your responsibility. We had no clearances
I remember,
of that.
Yes,
and then
right.
we just got a copy of it, and we sent you copies of yours. Now, at that point, did we already know that Deng would be accompanied by Fong Yi? I don't remember that.
We didn't invite him because we expected... No, we didn't know that. We invited Fong Yi because he had received Frank Press and the delegation on the cultural and educational exchanges back in July.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had Wang Jun, who was Minister of Culture. We had, I think, five or six ministers. And
it was perfectly balanced. We had the same.
The invitations were geared to their importance to us in the new relationship, obviously, was a consideration, but the American connection.
That's what we did. Right. We had Schlesinger, I think, Berglund, Brzezinski, Vance, and Mondale.
Right. And I know it on the 1st of January, we were, John Thompson and I were called over to the Science and Technology Commission at 9:30 in the morning. Or not to the commission, we were called to the Friendship Hotel to meet Chiang Ming, the vice chairman, I guess he would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose was to get their draft of the cultural agreement, which was worked out so that it could be signed when Deng Xiaoping came to the United States. And then we had I have it down as a media session in the residence. I think what that was the rehearsal for the evening event because of the tight quarters, so that everybody would know what was going to happen. And
who was your press officer during this time? Was that Thompson?
No. We handled the press at that time out of maybe John was doing it. It sort of floated around. We hadn't had enough business in that area to have a permanent officer.
And so, in effect, you were your own press officer too, with your long experience of handling the press. That was a lucky aspect of having you there. It was important for the ambassador, with the enormous glare of publicity, to be able to handle the thing with aplomb. And you certainly did that.
I noticed that on the 1st I had an interview with Linda and Jay Matthews, though they represented separate papers. They,
mm-hmm.
When I met with them in Hong Kong, I met with them separately, but they said, don't you think we'd save time?
Mm-hmm.
We do compare notes. And so I met with them together. They hadn't been there earlier.
Now, at this point, how were you being kept informed? It's terribly important to coordinate between what we were saying to the press in Washington and what you were saying. That's why one reason I ask about your press officer. We had standard Q's and A's. We had prepared Q's and A's for President Carter's briefing of the press. We had Q's and A's for Mondale. Now, were those sent out by state to you?
We had all those. But we were free to develop it as we saw fit.
Sure.
So I didn't go into any of these sessions with anything prepared. I just took it as it came.
But against the background, because in fact it worked out. At no point did you ever, or did we ever, disagree and open up the possibilities. Peking saying one thing about the nature of our agreement with the Chinese, and is Washington saying another. The absence of news is rarely noted, shall we say, but here was a moment of intense press scrutiny in two places, and the line was totally the same.
That's very true. And of course, they would have been trying to find differences,
sure,
because that's good news.
That's right, exactly.
I might say that on Christmas Eve, on New Year's Eve to 10:45, the CBS interview, what they had been trying to work out was a Face the Nation broadcast from Peking, but it didn't work because of satellite. Couldn't be tied in with the satellite to have it live, and the 10:45 thing was the and the next day I left for Canton to proceed to Bangkok for the annual Chiefs of Missions meeting, which that year was being held in Bangkok, and I got there on the Wednesday, the 3rd of January, and I know that at 10 o'clock at night, Holbrook called me to make sure that I would accept, be willing to accept the ambassadorship to the People's Republic of China, which I assured him.
You know, there were all sorts of rumors. Were you aware that there were rumors that the ambassador was going to be Jim Schlesinger?
Yes.
And I got a number of calls. I have no idea where that came from. Probably from nowhere, but I'm sure it was always the intention of everybody to have you as the ambassador. And I couldn't believe I read these things.
Those rumors were very strong, and I paid not much attention to it because I was reasonably sure that if the president had in mind anything like that, he would certainly have communicated with me first. And I had meetings in Bangkok with Mort Smith, with ICA, of course, by this time, as they have their man in place, but they're awfully anxious to get their full place in the sun in the new embassy. Frank Carlucci of CIA, deputy chief, whom I had known, of course, from his days as ambassador in Portugal, and Leo Moser, who was then the political man at SINCPAC in Honolulu.
Carlucci was first rate on matters dealing with China.
Yes, yes.
Did Len Unger make it down to this chief of missions meeting?
No.
He's had to stay in place until he left, I think, was the...
Right. And it was also done to make it clear he was no longer chief of an embassy.
Right.
Although, you know, since the consul general from Hong Kong routinely comes, it from our standpoint could have been justified, but it was done deliberately to.
Now, this is the time, too, when, I don't remember exactly, but when Warren Christopher flew out to Taipei and, along with Roger Sullivan and had that extraordinarily rocky and unpleasant reception, remember?
Yeah, when they were taken along that one route where all the demonstrators were congregated.
That's right.
Yes.
You know, as you recall, at this point, I suspect... from your vantage point, things were more relaxed. You had a number of CODELs, but slightly more relaxed than in Washington. The situation in Washington was as follows. First of all, because of the tight secrecy of normalization negotiations, very little work had been done on the Taiwan Relations Act that we knew had to be sent up. So there was frenzied involvement with the whole set of questions relating to Taiwan and how it would be handled on the Hill, also how we would get our troops off by the March deadline, how we would arrange for a military supply to Taiwan in the absence of diplomatic relations. Then we had the whole range of things that followed in the wake of normalization, beginning to plan for the Blumenthal trip, moving forward on establishing an economic relationship, a number of issues that had to begin to be confronted. And third, we had to plan for the trip of Deng Xiaoping. And then we had to handle the general intense public interest in China, which normalization had aroused. Of course, this was just a very intense period of work for all who were involved with China. During this period, in fact, I think going back to November after the Ohio State football game, from that Saturday until late April, I literally worked every day, and including Christmas and New Year's Day. And everyone was doing that. Chaz Freeman came back and was put in charge of a special program for public affairs and for handling the Taiwan side of things. Roger was involved in that deeply, but it was a very intense period. And I would say, looking back to the period where maybe